The following program is presented by the Nerdy Show Podcast Network, geeky programming for all nerds across the multiverse. All Nerdy Show programming is made possible by A Comic Shop, Orlando's number one comic shop and nerd destination, Nerdapalooza, the world's largest nerd music festival, and with the generous support of listeners like you. For more Nerdy Show podcasts, community forums, and learn how you can support this and other fine Nerdy Show programming, visit nerdyshow.com.
Hi, this is Bob Burton, creator of Flaming Carrot, Mystery Men, and also a hair club president, and you are listening to Nerdy Show. I don't always drink Dos Equis, but when I do, I drink it with skeletons.
Welcome to Nerdy Show, a weekly podcast dedicated to every facet of nerddom, from comics and video games to science and technology. If it's geeky, we've got it covered. And this is a Nerdy Show microsode. That means that we're going to talk about what you want us to talk about for about 15 minutes, maybe longer if we really like it. Hi, I'm Cap.
Hi, I'm Josh.
Hey, I'm Doug.
This episode was requested by Gundam King, and it's on the state of the film industry. And man, dude, what a heavy topic you have picked. It's, you know, I suppose it's a little lighthearted, but I mean,
also it's a little depressing.
It's a dirty.
Yeah.
I think it's uplifting.
I think at its heart, it's a romance story.
It's a dirty, dangerous place slumming it on the streets of Hollywood.
In a world that has turned slummy, three podcasting people will discuss.
I guess what we should do to sort of prime everybody for this discussion is just a very brief
background.
Background on us. I think we in this room have all are or have considered being filmmakers to some degree in this room. It's something that I was like all through high school and early college was shifting towards, but I've since moved down a different track. Maybe someday I've got lofty ideas, but I'm not going to, you know, hold my breath.
Mm-hmm.
Different story with you guys, though.
Yeah, I am holding my breath. currently holding my breath and taking a plunge is really what it is. I went to high school, went to college to be a filmmaker, and I was surprised that after getting out of college, they don't just give you the job with the resume saying I went to college to be a filmmaker. So there's that whole reality of it, but currently I'm in the similar boat as Josh, where, you know, we're writing scripts and doing what we can to bust in. But yeah, Josh, what was your background?
Oh, I went to high school, college, and studied writing, literary theory, way more focused on writing prose than screenplays and stuff. But then Doug wanted to get into writing screenplays, and we thought, hey, what can we do? Can we bang out a script that's saleable, you know, like legitimately and good in a short amount of time? The answer is no.
It turns out writing a screenplay is a lot harder. Well, it's only hard if you want to do a good one.
It's hard if you want to do a good one and you have a full-time job, if you both have full-time jobs otherwise.
Yeah.
So that's the problem. But we wrote a script and we like it. And what going down the final tweaks on our third draft, we're actually going to take the plunge.
Yeah, we're going to try to sell. We're going to really try hard to sell it.
Exactly. And then after that, we've got a couple others planned. We're working on another one at the same time. I'm writing a 30-page short film script. And as far as film goes, that's pretty much it.
I guess the reality of it is that, you know, we're not podcasting from Hollywood or anywhere on the West Coast. We're podcasting from Orlando, Florida, which though at one time during the 90s, it was a hotbed for film activity that totally dried up. So that's not the playing field anymore. And our perspective is based on things we've seen, people we know, and the rumors that we as press people in and around media with lots of friends who are actually active in the industry, things we know about how shit is over there.
Well, now that you know the background on all of us, that's where we're our starting point.
Right.
So it's like, so now we can kind of launch into it. On the topic of Orlando being the new hotbed of the film industry,
former hotbed of
the film industry, people were using the phrase New Hollywood a lot.
Actually a Hollywood, Florida.
There is a Hollywood, Florida.
It's very nice, but it's not what you think it is.
No. Because it's nice because it's not the Hollywood. That's the difference, is that it's nice because there's no film.
It is a bit slummy at parts, but I kind of like it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, good thrift stores.
One of the reasons that's like why Universal Studios is here, they have actual sound stages where they actually shoot real things. And, you know, at Hollywood Studios of Disney, it was MGM Studios, they were using to shoot real things. One of the theories I've heard as to why they are not shooting more movies here, because they were trying very hard in the 90s, because it was, I don't know, maybe the tax of the land, I don't know, whatever the incentives was.
There were better tax incentives back then. All of them are not intact to this day. So there's that.
I heard that one of the biggest reasons why it ended up not working out is because of the weather. Because if you are shooting an exterior scene for a feature film, every minute is costing a lot of money. If you're in California and it, you know, this cliche is it never rains, you know, you can go outside and, you know,
the cliche and the goddamn truth.
Yeah. You know, so it never rains in California. You can go outside, you can shoot, and it can be any time of the year. It can be any whatever. And you're not going to get rained out. In Florida, if you're trying to shoot on location, and we learned this the hard way when we were shooting a feature film,
yep.
We're outside and we set everything right. You know, the levels are good. You know, everything's looking good. The sound is fine. The lighting is great. Let's roll. You start rolling. And not a rain cloud, but just a cloud just comes into the shot and just completely fucks up what you've been doing. You've been measuring for the light for this one shot. And you're like, fuck, we got to scrap that shot. The performance was great. Well, you know, at least we're on tape. We're on digital. So, you know, we're not wasting film. But you just wasted, you know, 10 minutes. Now you got to redo it. And you know, now a rain cloud is coming. You're going to get rained out. Now you're fucked for the whole
Hollywood production, it doesn't matter. Like, the film's not the most expensive part.
Oh, no. But
it's
having the people
stick around.
But so the weather was a problem, which caused a money problem, which caused a reliability problem, which means, well, shit, why do I need to fly out to Florida when I can just drive downtown and shoot on the old sound stages there?
And that's kind of the fun reason that it didn't work. And definitely a true one. The other reason, which is considerably less fun and deals with how the industry's kind of fucked, is the fact that this is something I heard, which may be not particularly true, but I don't know. We'll
figure it out.
Is that they couldn't convince enough Hollywood film lawyers to actually move to Florida to establish the infrastructure, the legal infrastructure that Florida needed to maintain its Hollywood of the East status.
That could be true too. Yeah.
It could be true, but if there's something I know about lawyers, is that if you have something that is under contention, they will appear.
They'll follow the money.
They'll come out of the ground. Like, you don't need the ones from California. New ones will appear. But that may be true. I don't know. Maybe they only trust their entertainment lawyers.
Maybe. It was a mixture of a lot of stuff. But either way, that's why I never really came to Orlando. But this ain't state of the film industry in Orlando. This is, you know, nationwide or whatever.
That said, it is blossoming over in Louisiana, largely because they have some kick-ass tax breaks over
there. They do.
Well, because they're rebuilding the fucking city that was destroyed.
They're moving pretty hard for it.
Before Katrina.
That's true. Yeah, you're right.
They're pushing pretty hard for it in Hawaii right now.
Yeah.
Which would be awesome.
I heard they're actually trying to open up a studio in Hawaii with a sound stage and with an animation department.
Yeah, they're trying to. I think there's a couple animation companies that are actually vying to be an animation department.
What was the animation company that did the Final Fantasy film? Square.
They own it.
Square created Final Fantasy. They started their own animation department to create the film.
I may be wrong, but I think when they made the film, that animation studio was based in Hawaii at the time.
I think you're right, actually. It's closer to Japan. They did that and Advent Children and then some
and the Animatrix.
And the Animatrix, you're right. Mm-hmm.
Anywho, so how do we feel about the current state? You know, I think a lot of people would agree, a lot of moviegoers would agree that it's
California.
I'm not talking about location, but just like the current temperature of the quality of work that we're getting is kind of
we're seeing a lot of shitty movies, a lot of very expensive, very shitty movies.
I was actually just talking to my good friend Blake, who's one of the Ghostbusters from season one. We were talking about this, and Blake's like one of my greatest friends of all time, and he has a somewhat cynical outlook on the state of the film industry.
Mm-hmm.
He's got that point of view, and I'm kind of an optimist to a fault sometimes, even though I may joke otherwise. We were discussing, you know, why are there so many shitty things, and because no one's caring, and where are the great filmmakers? Like, where's the next Scorsese? Where's the next Hitchcock? Where's the next, you know, anything? There's no person out there right now that's supposed to be like top of their game, an amazing filmmaker who wasn't already an amazing filmmaker in the 80s or the 70s.
I would argue Aronofsky.
In the
90s is more current.
Yeah, but he's nowhere near as like prolific or as groundbreaking.
Where are the visionaries that kids and young filmmakers are going to look up to?
Yeah, you know, yeah.
Where are the astronauts, you know?
Yeah, well, and then I said...
Alfonso Cuarón.
Yeah, no, he's good. But he's not very prolific either. Like, you know, I was talking with a bunch of friends, and we were talking about good filmmakers today. Like, for example, we're talking about good thriller and suspense films, and we were discussing, Christopher Nolan, Inception is like very, you know, it's like a very great movie. And then there's like Insomnia, Memento, and like all these things. He does these things, even outside of the Batman movies. Yeah, it's a good quality filmmaker. He's done a lot of good stuff. And then you got like David Fincher. Mm-hmm. You know, he's done a lot of good stuff. You know, like, this is really good. Dude, none of them even come close to someone like Alfred Hitchcock. Like, and I'm not talking about quality. I just mean quantity even. Alfred Hitchcock.
Prolific.
He's made 50 great films just when he came to Hollywood, not even including when he was still in England.
I mean, William Goldman, the reason that it would take so long is because everything's so fucking expensive now.
That's verbatim what he said. Things were expensive back then too, but like there's this documentary, and it was a book, I think it was a book then, it was a documentary called Easy Riders, Raging Bulls. And it talks about the state of the film industry like in the 60s. Like, I'm sure all the Star Wars fans out there might know a lot about how Star Wars came about at a time when Vietnam and things were bad and blah, 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 blah. Then this great thing, Star Wars, comes out. It wasn't just that the people wanted a very positive thing. It was also that the film industry itself was kind of collapsing. Large studios were going bankrupt because of like large disaster films and just like really gimmicky shit. Like the 3D in the 1950s was like a big contributor. And like all of these things, the film industry started to tank, and then suddenly the blockbuster is invented. And then they're like, oh my gosh, a whole new generation where it's kind of the director is God in that sense. And so let's just get these young filmmakers out of college, give them a ton of money. So no longer are the studio heads in charge of making creative decisions. It's more of the directors, and even less so the writers. And now, of course, there's examples of it being the opposite way. There's always, it's a mixture. History's never that clear.
And this is an interesting cycle that happens to a lot of creative industries. The same thing happened with comic books in, say, the 1980s.
Yeah,
When they prioritized creators like Grant Morrison and Alan Moore and so on, and let them have their way. And then, of course, as we're seeing right now in the film industry and in the comic industry in the recent past, sooner or later, the studios take over again, or they find ways to put their stooges in charge. Cough, Michael Bay, as stooges. Corporate stooges. I mean, he gets to do what he wants, but he's not a visionary, for fuck's sake.
Yeah. Now, the interesting thing, when I was talking to Blake, and he's like, yeah, that's, you know, whatever. Yeah. But, you know, like, that's the past and things are different. Like, yeah, but the reason why things are sucking now, some people would draw the comparison like, oh, there was disaster films back then, like the Poseidon Adventure and Towering Inferno. And they were all like kitschy sort of popcorny films and people were tired of them. I'm like, dude, but we get Day After Tomorrow. We get 2012. It's history's kind of repeating itself.
Even in like the 90s, they had this fall off of disaster films like Volcano and terrible ones that now, didn't happen in a row.
Now here, because I'm split on how I feel, because on one hand, I'm like, yeah, history's repeating itself. Does that mean something good is on the horizon? Are they going to lose so much money that they're eventually going to start taking bigger risks, and therefore the risks like Star Wars? Because Star Wars was a risk for them at the time.
Yeah.
And it paid off, you know, like Star Wars. There's nothing else you can compare it to. Same thing for Jaws, you know, like whatever. So like huge risks, big payoff, reinvigorates the whole industry. They're thinking about things differently. What's that next big thing or whatever? And is it even going to happen? Because it seems like now, you know, like there was an article about Spielberg and Lucas talking about how they think Hollywood's on the verge of collapse, because if there's three flops in a row for one studio, that's going to be it.
It can bankrupt the studio now.
But here's the thing. Maybe that was true in the 70s or the 80s, but not really anymore, because most studios have a corporate parent that is so huge, it'll never go bankrupt.
It's true.
Like NBC, first of all, Universal Studios. It's really NBC Universal. Mm-hmm. NBC Universal is actually owned by GE. Is GE going to go bankrupt anytime soon?
General Electric owns those guys?
Yes.
Whoa.
Yes. So Universal, the amount of money that Universal makes per year, profit per year on any of their films is, I'm just going to make up a number. This is a fake number. Let's just say it's $500 million. Let's say the profit for 1 year is $500 million. Compared to what GE makes in a year, that's a drop in the bucket. Universal could make flop after flop after flop for the next 10 years, and GE won't give a shit, because the amount of money they're expecting to make off Universal is nothing. I think that's the problem. There is no incentive for Universal to take a risk. Now, I'm bashing Universal, but this is true for all of the major film studios. There's really no incentive to take a risk and have it pay off in a huge way. Like, you can take a risk like, well, are we going to risk making a Harry Potter sequel if there's no book created? Like, no. It's like there's so many sequels that are being churned out because they're sure bets. The people who work at these studios, they want to make good films and they want to keep their jobs. You do that by making, like, well, how can we guarantee a hit? You really can't guarantee a hit. Well, we can kind of manufacture a hit if we get the right people involved, get the right buzz going, get the right advertising going. And then by the time the film comes out, if it costs, say, $80 million to make, if it's like a comedy and it costs like $80 to $100 million to make, if in that opening weekend we can make 60 to 80 million opening, we know within 2 weeks we're going to make our money back, maybe a little plus on top. And that's all we really need. So
everything you're saying is legit. You know, it's a very convoluted industry, and it plays to what's kind of confusing about capitalism and the machine of capitalism and how it exists because we believe it to exist. And so it just keeps eating its own tail.
Well, here's a good example from the early 90s. That's something that's near and dear to my heart, which is Ghostbusters 2.
Right.
Ghostbusters came out, the first one, huge hit, mega hit, you know, whatever. Ever since then, people were talking about Ghostbusters 2. Just like, oh, we want Ghostbusters 2, Ghostbusters 2. They didn't really know what they wanted to do. Bill Murray wasn't really that interested. The guy who was in charge of Columbia at the time wasn't that interested either for various reasons. The heads of studios change, like, all the time. It's like a revolving door. There's a guy who came into Columbia at the time who didn't want to do any of the big, you know, Hollywood stuff. He wanted to do, like, real human drama and stuff. So he did a lot of, like, smaller films that weren't big commercial successes. So he was fired. Then, at that time, Coca-Cola bought out Columbia Pictures. So Coca-Cola puts in a guy who's now in charge, who, for all intents and purposes, doesn't have to know anything about the movie industry. And he's like, okay, Ghostbusters was a huge hit, sequel now. And they put it on Fast Track. And then they just throw enough money at it that Bill Murray has to say yes. And they make Ghostbusters 2. Now, I like Ghostbusters 2.
I like it too.
It's a good sequel. It's just not as good as the first, but, you know, whatever. That's a whole other podcast. I think that same exact scenario is happening today, but with people who care less about the quality of the film and more about, I want to keep my job as a studio head executive. I got to make a profit in order to do that, because if I don't make a profit, the corporate guys on top of me are going to say, you're not feeding the machine. We'll find someone who does.
And the problem, too, is that they're getting all these guesses about, oh, you can't do this, or you can't do this, you know, never kill the dog. You know, never do this. And they're all bullshit.
Call like, Kick-Ass too.
It's all bullshit rules that everybody makes up because they think they understand the system. And to understand the system, you really just have to understand what entertains people. That's it.
You're speaking like an optimist. Because the system that we're talking about is not how to make a good movie. It's how to make money.
Correct. But they are one and the same. It doesn't seem that way. But if you want to continually make money, you have to make good things. Like
I agree.
Because if you make a bad thing to shit it out, you make a shitty sequel.
But it still makes money.
The sequel makes money, but you're not going to release a third one.
Do I need to tell you about the Alvin and the Chipmunks movies?
Well, that's all right.
Or Smurfs.
Fair enough.
Or any of that shit.
But are those objectively bad for children?
I wouldn't be qualified to answer that.
I don't know either.
I have no idea.
Yeah, but if the kids want to see him again, I mean, you're not worried about whether or not the parents enjoy it.
But when I was a kid, I would watch shitty TV shows all the time just because it was a cartoon that was on TV. Not even because I genuinely liked it.
I would watch everything but Saved by the Bell.
See, but here's the thing about family films. If you can get a kid to see the Smurfs trailer and a Smurf makes a fart and the kid laughs and says he wants to see it, boom, automatically at least two tickets are sold because you have to have a parent take a kid. So these are commercial hits, not even because parents even like them. But if a parent is like, oh, God, I want my kid to shut up for 2 hours. I'm in the mall. I'm tired. I want to sit down in the dark in the air conditioned, maybe drink a soda.
I feel like spending $60.
Yeah. Well, how about we swing into a movie theater and I can just relax and the kid can watch whatever Smurf is on the movie screen and I can just have a mini vacation for 2 hours. And that's fine. Like I have no problem with that. But I think that type of stuff is giving stuff like the Smurfs and Alvin and the Chipmunks and all that stuff this feeling of a huge success, so the movie companies are going to keep on turning them out.
But the ones that are done better make more money, like Despicable Me, mm-hmm. you know, and How to Train Your Dragon. Like, these movies are bigger commercial successes because they are objectively better.
But there's no incentive to try that much harder when it's easy just to sort of skim across the surface. Because I'm not trying to say people in Hollywood are evil and the executives are stupid or anything like that. People just want to keep their jobs.
Well, here's the thing, though. There is incentive in the sense that there's a huge amount of competition, even if it's just perceived, because it's not real competition. The movie's going to do however it's going to do. Unless you're talking about opening weekend, people are only going to see however many movies on this opening weekend. But we're talking about movies that are getting made, like physically being made at the time. There's a competition to try to do better than so-and-so, so your job is justified. Because if you all do bad, but one of you does better, even if it's not great, you're saying, hey, I was in a bad market here, and I'm doing better than my peers. And then you'll keep your job. I think part of this discussion is going to, like, the shitty movies, is that a lot of people believe that movies are now just written by the numbers. And that goes all the way back to, like, there's all these screenplay writers.
But before you even go there, it's like, here's the thing. You're talking about shitty movie after shitty movie after shitty movie. And you're saying, well, why don't they just try a little bit harder to make a good film? Well, there's people out there who probably genuinely want to make good films, but they want to take a risk. But the people who are in charge of the money are saying, no. If you take too big of a risk, you're going to alienate some people. We got to get as many people in here as possible. So for you to be creatively risky or to make a good film or to do something different, like you're saying, it's difficult to convince somebody to give you the money to try something different when they know if they don't try something different and go with a formula that can at least make the money back and a little bit and some, that's the safe bet. But the risky bet is to try to make something different and unique that feasibly, if you take a bigger risk and make it different enough, it could be a blockbuster or it's a major stinker and it never makes its
money
back.
I'm going to use a weird example. Like, look at Boondock Saints. Boondock Saints is an indie movie and a balls to the wall film where they did a lot of stuff that if that movie had been fast-tracked through Hollywood with the right people attached to it, you just wouldn't have seen. You wouldn't have seen Willem Dafoe as a cross-dressing gay police officer, detective, or whatever he was.
Right, right.
You maybe wouldn't have seen as much violence. Whereas, like, Kick-Ass 2, which, you know, came out recently, like, I liked it, but there was a bunch of stuff that didn't happen from the comic book that was not the stuff that was cut for budget reasons, not the stuff that was cut for other reasons. I'm talking about, like, things that were simply not featured in the film and maybe even never considered to be featured in the film, because they broke some of those rules of, like, safe filmmaking, even though it's a rated R movie made for people going, oh my God, can you believe that fucked up shit? They chose to do, like, toilet humor instead of certain decapitations or a rape or
which ties into
destruction,
like,
to New York City and a terrorist nature.
Right. Right. See, because that's the film industry. But if you go to, if you take that thing to HBO, like Game of Thrones.
Right. Different story.
That's why TV is supposed to be, like, in this golden age now. As opposed to film or whatever.
The thing, too, is the exact things you're talking about make me so worried about the Ender's Game movie. because I can't believe that Ford would sign on to a movie that had this kind of content.
He seems like he's just making movies right now. He's like, I wasn't making them for a while, and now I'm making them.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure if he's being too discerning. I mean, hey, the cast for Cowboys versus Aliens was great, as was the cinematography and a lot of other things, but the script was terrible. So
because it was manufactured to be a Hollywood blockbuster.
It was.
Because, like, I read a lot of the comic, and the comic, this is a lot of differences from the comic and
the comic was actually a point of scandal, because the comic was printed solely so it could be sold as a film.
Oh, that makes sense.
And okay. In fact, I think to get their sales up, they bought their own book to make it look like it was hot.
Oh, that's fucking.
And
that's
so they actually created a new policy through Diamond Distributors to make sure it never happened again.
Wow.
See, here's the thing, though. A lot of time people will say, oh, this movie sucked because the script was bad. We didn't read the first draft. Like, we have no idea.
We didn't read the shooting draft. The movie you shoot with the shooting draft of the script can get cut out in the editing room. Dude, perfect example, I Am Legend with Will Smith. I went to see the movie. It was good. I had fun. I walked up the movie going, man, that ending was kind of weird. Turns out that wasn't the original ending. Like, there's the alternate ending. Maybe someone has the DVD, the alternate ending. Yeah.
There may be several alternate endings, or...
All I know is...
You're talking about the one with the blood butterfly, right?
Yeah. Like, and I won't go into too much detail, because if you need to see the movie, just see the movie. But there's an alternate ending that I think is way better than the one that they showed in theaters. Yeah. And I'm like, why in the world did they change it? Well, because there was a test screening and some people didn't like the original ending. And then that test audience doesn't like the original ending. They say, we got to rewrite an ending that is more whatever. So then that's what the general public gets. I'm like, but that original ending was trying to say something that you were establishing throughout the entire movie. But the new ending doesn't even acknowledge that thread. The plot thread being the vampire monsters that are running around. They're
maybe,
just monsters.
Maybe it didn't test well, Doug.
Yeah, they're brainless. They're brainless monsters. They have no heart. They have no soul. They're just fucking monsters. And the original ending presupposes this idea of, no, maybe there's a little bit of humanity left in them.
It makes me wonder how One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest ending tested.
I don't think it did test.
They probably didn't worry about that shit because it was already, like, that's the other thing. If you were to make One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest today, it'd be like, oh, well, you know, it's based on a successful play, so it made whatever.
It would be a Lifetime movie, and it would be very uplifting.
Well, to be fair, at the time, they went, hey, you know what? We got a movie about a guy who goes into a nut house.
Who pretends to be crazy,
and we got Jack Nicholson. We could have him shit unicorns at the end, and it wouldn't matter. People will see this movie.
But this goes into the thing where you're saying that, like, about it being formulaic.
Yeah, kind of paint by numbers. And it's a lot of people are accusing it of that. And I think
in some cases it is true.
In some cases it's true, but I think a lot of that comes down to post-production or even pre-production. Like, you've got something that's very much not by the numbers. Mm-hmm. And the further it goes along and the more money that gets spent, people are starting to go, I don't know. Yeah, because
there's the movie you write, there's the movie you shoot, and then there's the movie you edit.
Exactly. Right. And there's just so much waste in Hollywood. I'm talking, like, insane amounts of waste. Okay, you're making a multi-million dollar picture here, right? So you got to spend all this money. That entitles directors to be lazy, not appear on set, have somebody else direct the movie for them, but still get to put their name on it because they're in a special club that lets them put their name on it. And therefore, if they don't like something and someone screws something up, they can spend thousands, maybe even millions of dollars, say, shooting one place because of a favor that someone did for something else, gets kind of like mafia rules about, you know, scratching someone's back. And all of a sudden, you know, you're faking a tropical beach somewhere that doesn't need to be one. You're flying in trees from another place. And then those trees die and you have to manufacture fake trees from China.
And then delay shooting and then exactly. Cost more money. It just comes down to my philosophy on is that if there's too many cooks in the kitchen, you're going to dilute the product. So if you have a producer who's too involved, or if you have an executive who's too involved, and they all have their say, they're all good. Everybody wants to make the best movie possible. In theory, you know, nobody wants to make a flop unless it's Mel Brooks, the producers. You know, it's like that's a fictional, fun little story. But if everyone's trying to make the best movie possible, everybody has different opinions. Everybody has, I control more money, therefore I have more say. You're going to dilute the final product. It's going to be something that's soft edges. You know, there's nothing deep or excessive about it or exciting or whatever.
At the end of the day, you can never count on big Hollywood to be making a film that is going to be memorable and treasured. It's right. If it happens, then lucky you.
Yeah.
And lucky everybody involved.
Right.
But the special films, unless by a fluke, because the industry is simply not what it was in the mid-late 70s, it's just not going to happen. And what's more, the entire paradigm of the entertainment industry is completely shifting. Speaking from a futurist slant, what Lucas and Spielberg were saying, in the future, you're going to have to spend $60 to go see a film, and it's going to be a special...
Maybe
seeing a movie in a theater is going to be like going to the opera. Maybe that's going to happen, because the fact is that everything is shifting, and technology is changing, and sooner or later, we are going to see virtual environments and so on that will be more immersive, and ultimately, it's going to be, who's the best storyteller?
It's always going to go back to that.
Yeah. And when will the equipment to make a convincing, realistic story in whatever medium, be it film or television or some kind of full immersion technology, if that power gets to the people, which it's likely to because of just how technology is shifting and what any of us in this room are capable of doing thanks to the big changes in technology within the last decade, never mind the last two decades, ultimately, the power is always only going to be in our hands. And if we want to make something big, well... it's a pipe dream, because the guy who did Tron Legacy, I don't remember his name off the top of my head, he was nobody. He was absolutely nobody, and he filmed out of pocket his own pitch for Tron. This is a very abbreviated version of the story, mm-hmm. but, you know, he pitched Tron to Disney, and they said, we don't know you, pal, but my God, you got balls, and this looks great. You got a shot, kid.
Mm-hmm.
That's one guy.
And right. then they wrote it as they went along.
Yeah.
But that's the thing. So, like, let's just, you know, Spielberg and Lucas have all said, like, oh, man, I wish I was making films today because the technology makes it so easy or whatever. It's so different or whatever. It's like, if we gave everyone in the United States a film crew, like the equivalent, if this was like 20 years in the future and you could make a Hollywood quality film by yourself with a computer that can automatically render all these things to make it look amazing, that doesn't mean we're going to have a million Martin Scorsese's. It means we're going to have a million really fucking shitty films,
right?
And maybe one guy accidentally makes a masterpiece. Because
I wouldn't say it's accidentally. You have a guy out there who has an easier time making a masterpiece.
Or one guy works really, really hard, and he struggled, and he makes a masterpiece.
Here's the thing, though. I think it already is kind of shifting, because a lot of people in Hollywood are starting to realize that there's some directors out there that can pull in talent for very little money,
right?
And turn a huge profit, like Aronofsky made Black Swan. On, you know, piecemeal budget.
Right.
And it did fantastic. I mean, it did very well, won award. It was awesome.
But it's not the Avengers.
It's not the Avengers. But everybody says, oh, well, the Avengers made more money. And that's fine. But for you can't make...
That's a special situation that has only ever existed once so far.
Hollywood doesn't give a shit, though.
You can't afford to make 5 Avengers a year with one studio. You could make 50 Black Swans, you know?
Right.
But
right.
as long as it was good. And the thing is, they invested in good talent. And he says, hey, the whole pitch of Black Swan was that it was going to be really inexpensive. It was all going to be handheld. It was all going to be from one person's viewpoint. Mm-hmm. And if a director who's known to be able to turn that kind of things gets in contact with good actors and things like that, people will see it. That's all there is to it. I mean, if it's good, people will know.
Again, tying into the idea of the formula. What was the article that was making the rounds?
It was called Save the Movie, the 2005 screenwriting book that's taken over Hollywood and made every movie feel the same.
Right. That article was like an attack on the series of books called Save the Cat by Blake Snyder, which is a screenwriting help book of, you know, hey, if you want to write a screenplay, try this or whatever.
Or like if you're having trouble, if you don't know how to start, here's a good starting point.
Which, you know, in the books, in the Save the Cat books, it lines out 15 beats. Your movie needs to have these beats. It needs to happen between pages 1 and 5. This needs to happen. Between pages 10 and 20, this needs to happen. So on and so on and so on. And this article was criticizing that, just being like, that's why movies are formulaic, because they'll take this thing and it literally gives you the formula, literally, of the page count, the page number, what to do on what page, boom, you have a movie. And while I guess that's true, one, that's not the aim of the book, which, you know, that's a whole other thing altogether. I don't think a lot of quote unquote Hollywood insiders really care about what one guy wrote in one screenwriting book.
They don't.
I don't think movie executives have the book in their drawer at their desk and, like, you know, like the movie The Player or whatever. It's like, oh, some guy comes in, pitches a story. He's going to hand him, you need to read this book by a guy who once wrote Blank Check, and therefore follow his instructions and we'll make an instant hit.
Do you think they, after Joss Whedon pitched them the Avengers and handed them the first draft,
did they in return save the cat?
They went, you know, on page 5, we don't really have an initializing action here.
Yeah,
so
Tony Stark needs to save the cat here. What can he do?
The thing is, there is sort of a collective unconsciousness. Like, this book is out in the world, and so that's happening. The thing that this article really harps on is that there are so many plot beat similarities between a lot of films that were happening at the time. And what you guys are touching on there is the Loki lets himself get kidnapped thing, same as Joker lets himself get kidnapped, and dude with no face lets himself get kidnapped. That's a pretty noticeable one.
True.
Right. And they go on in this article to list all these other beats, but I think it's the same reason that Hollywood made two Asteroid films at the same time. Hollywood's currently developing two films at the same time based on the life of the Beatles manager, Brian Epstein.
Yeah.
Every year there's something, and it's this cycle. It's all people talking to one another. It's the way that the human mind in mass
works.
Throw
a little bit of the collective unconscious in there as well. Yeah, like, you know,
it's a feedback loop.
Yeah. Like, the article also implies that the reason that these movies sound the same is because producers care about this book.
Right, yeah,
and it's
Which is not true.
I hear from professional screenwriters, they're like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Like, nobody ever even heard of this book.
Yeah, they're like, listen, I write my films, I take notes, I do this, and that's the end of it. Like, there's no mention of Save the Cat. And Craig Mazin put it, he says, listen.
Who is that?
He's a professional screenwriter. He wrote Hangovers 2 and 3 and the recent Identity Thief, and things like that. He's like, look, you can take any of these systems. This is me saying this. So I'll get to his quote.
Joseph Campbell, Hero's Journey.
Sid Field, any of these guys, and you can overlay their system on any movie that's made, and you're going to find similarities.
Yeah. It's like fitting Nostradamus's prophecies into world
events. Exactly. Yeah,
because at the bottom line, here's what a screenplay is. Starts off, you're introduced to whoever's in it. Conflict happens. We don't know what to do. We figure out what to do. We resolve the conflict.
And through that conflict, hopefully your character has an arc.
Exactly.
Like, in the best films, the character has an arc.
I'm going to write a screenplay book. It's going to be 3 pages long. It's going to say that. But no, Craig Mazin goes, he says, listen, you don't want to read these books from screenwriters who failed and made way more money selling this book
than they ever did being
screenwriters to sell you their system, which they've never tried and doesn't work. So it's a waste of time.
Yeah. I'm going to make so much money in this pyramid scheme. I'm going to lose all this weight.
It's true.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, to be fair, like, I think it's a good idea to read these books because these people do have legitimate experiences.
Right. Like, my philosophy as wanting to be a writer working professionally was learn everything that I can and then fuck the rest. Like, just set it and forget it. Like, let it stew in the brain. And if something that I think is applicable, I'll do it. It's like Bruce Lee, be like water. Just, you know, you go with whatever's gonna be working for whatever idea you're working on.
Now, there is a screenwriting book that Doug and I would recommend.
Yeah, if there's one,
it's writing movies,
making movies for fun and profit.
It is the most.
That seems legit.
It is incredibly legit,
and it's incredibly hilarious.
It's a very funny book. It's written by two guys from the state.
And Reno 911.
And okay, Reno 911, yeah.
Which ones?
Thomas Lennon and Carlos something. I forgot his last name. They write this book, and it's like, listen, if you're having trouble with writing your characters, try to pick an actor. People say, don't write movies for an actor. No, do it anyway, because it'll give them a distinct voice, and you can change the actor later. Things like that, you know, just like quick tips.
That is good advice.
It is good advice.
Like, they say, try to cut out your vices, like, while you're writing a screenplay, if you're really stressed out. We say, fuck that. Yeah, you know how many vices Ernest Hemingway cut out when he was making an amazing story? None. It's just like, just drink all you want. If you want a guaranteed hit, become a drunkard, and they tell you how to do it. Like, it's all very funny.
Listen, you have to move to L.A. if you're going to be a serious screenwriter. And because you're going to have to move to L.A., we're going to help you out. Here's the secret menu for In-N-Out Burger.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's a fantastic book about screenwriting, and they talk about everything.
They say, for example, go watch the movie Die Hard. Go ahead, we'll wait. And then you turn the page, and it's like, that was Kick-Ass, wasn't it? And it's like, and then they'll go on to explain.
No, it was Die Hard, Doug.
Yeah, it was fucking awesome. Yeah, it wasn't Kick-Ass, it was Die Hard.
So actually. Yeah, but one of the things they do is they really harp on interaction with people in the industry. So how to take notes, how to basically corral your fury at somebody talking about your work. Yeah. And they said, you're going to get horrible experiences as a result. And they list their experiences. They wrote an Ant-Man movie.
Whoa.
The two of them.
Shit.
They wrote an Ant-Man movie, and the first note-giving session that they sit down with the head producer, comes in, starts giving notes about how he's like, listen, like,
at some point, shouldn't he? No, wait, was it Ant-Man or was it The Incredible Shrinking Man?
I thought it was Ant-Man. Maybe it's The Incredible
Shrinking
Man.
Either way, the plot was that it's a guy who shrinks. And he's just like, yeah, I think at some point he needs to like maybe fight like a grasshopper
He says, I just want them to interact with an animal.
At any point in this movie,
I just want them to interact with an animal. And they said, and we touched our pens to our faces, went, interesting. And then he walked off, not counting for the fact that in this movie he interacts with a panther, a grasshopper. It's like five movies.
And he clearly had just never read the script.
He never read the script. And they're like, where's that? So you're going to meet people like this.
Who are giving you notes, having never read anything that you do.
But your job is to not get angry. And what are the other tips they say? They say, like, if somebody's giving you notes, keep a notepad with you and write down what they say, because they're going to change what they say if they know you're actually writing it down.
they're very big on just being a team player. Like, don't be the asshole in the room. Get your movie made. Don't worry about that shit.
It's actually a very optimistic book about screenwriting and the state of the movie industry, because, look, you don't have to be really that good if you're willing to be part of the team, because everything's a team effort in the movie industry.
Yeah. And as you can tell, this microsode, it got beefed up a little bit by Josh and Doug's sheer willpower.
Well, we have a lot to say, obviously.
We go on for another few hours.
We do go on for hours. We're going to be in the car on the way home being like, oh,
I would have stopped you if it wasn't interesting. Yeah. So like, you know, so good. Thanks so much to Gundam King. If you want a Nerdy Show microsode, all you got to do is support us. Pass our $100 mark, each successive $100 mark, you know, 100, 200, etc. That means you get to choose what we talk about for 15 minutes to start.
Normally.
And longer if we chase a wild hare. Right now, we're going to do a little update on our currently running RPG support drive. That's a theme support drive for this month, where you can choose which tabletop role-playing game we play for our next RPG one-shot. In our previous one-shot, we played Paranoia XP, and the next one is all up to you. Currently in the lead is the Firefly role-playing system. Originally, we had this slated as the Serenity or Firefly system, just to clarify that Serenity was in fact Firefly, because there was a role-playing system made after the Firefly film Serenity came out. However, an actual Firefly RPG was recently unveiled. I know what you say. Well, okay, if Serenity wasn't Firefly, then what was it? Well, contractually, that role-playing system could only pertain to things from the Firefly universe featured in the film Serenity, so it was very limited. This one is the whole enchilada, or at least the corner of the verse from the series, which is, you know, considerably more expansive than Serenity itself. So if we need to mix and match, we will, but we're going to be looking at using the brand new Firefly role-playing system for this. So that's in the lead with $203. Just behind that is Call of Cthulhu at $171. In third place, Star Wreck at $168, followed by Dresden Files at $111. Beyond that, the number amounts are much lower. However, if you look at how quickly these systems rose to the occasion, you'll see that even with, say, Sagas Modern or World of Darkness being at $18 and $13 respectively, that can change pretty quickly. Star Wreck, no one had even heard of it until M started posting about it on the forums and got enough people interested that they all chipped in. So if you've got a system that you want to see us play that's not on this list or that's at the bottom of this list, it can still happen. All you got to do is pick up the cause. Nicholas Kratzer said, just making my own small contribution to the Dresden Files. I'd love to see you guys dish out some crazy modern day magic. Some words of warning. Never trust a fairy, and beware the nickelheads. Keala said, totally voting for Serenity Firefly on this one. Keep up the good work, guys. And then later, I've decided that Serenity Firefly has to stay in the running. Here's a hundo. And you best believe that dude has thrown down big time, like a motherfucking Roosevelt. He then went on to say, looks like a few people want Call of Cthulhu. Well, maybe they should start chanting, Ia Ia Kealis Fintang, because I'm not letting them win. Another 50 to Serenity Firefly. Dude, serious, but he's just one man. There's strength in numbers. Can you take on Kaelis? There might be a war brewing. Bryce Harris said, you guys don't need an RPG to be big damn heroes. Fningli, Mgulnath, Cthulhu, Wraith, Waganagal, Fatagan. Suffice it to say, he threw down for Call of Cthulhu. And then Bryce supported us again and said, this has been stagnant too long. Let's get the ball rolling again. May the deep ones rise to break the minds of us mortals. Arceus said, I was all set to try to get some momentum behind Shadowrun, but Starrex sounds like way too much fun to pass up on. Live long and profit, my friends. Just keep sending in that gold-pressed latinum, or whatever the Starrex equivalent is. Caitlin Kruger said, Dresden Files for the win. Matthew Shoemaker sent us a little equation. He said, Starrex 10, Sagas Modern 5, Dresden Files 3, Dragon Age 2, and just for a little old nerdy show, 5. So we broke it down and spread it all out. Anti-Luke said, Call of Cthulhu is the only system I'll GM. Of course I need to support it. And last, but definitely not least, Big Balla Big Bad Shadow Man said, $5 for the new Ghostbusters episode, $1 for Call of Cthulhu, and another for Starrex. The RPG support drive is running all month long. If you have any questions, why, you can just email info@nerdyshow.com or hit us up on Facebook or the forums. If you want to add an RPG to the list that's currently not up there, you totally can, and there's still enough time to raise some hell. And if you want to mobilize one of the so far unloved systems, then let your flag fly. For all you Dungeons & Doritos fans, it might be of interest to you that this support drive is all geared towards reaching a $900 stretch goal, whereupon we'll be sending out to all the supporters an unaired episode of Dungeons & Doritos, completely out of continuity. You can hear us talk about that in the two prior episodes. We're currently at $720 out of that $900, very, very close. And beyond that, if you guys get us to $900 before the end of the month, there are some stretch goals we can implement. But also, D&D fans, you might want to keep an eye on the website on Tuesday, because something that's long been neglected may be rearing its head again. That's all I'll say for now. Thanks so much for listening. Bye, I'm Cap.
Bye, I'm Josh.
Bye, I'm Doug.
And taking us out, something completely unrelated, but a recent release and very cool, the Blake Robinson Synthetic Orchestra put together an album called The Chrono Trigger Symphony, Volume 1. And it's a selection of music from Chrono Trigger reinterpreted in a symphonic style as though there was, say, a Chrono Trigger film. So the track that Hex has selected for you is simply titled The Chrono Trigger Symphony, merging many themes and inviting you into the world of Chrono Trigger.
This is Bartholomew Elfgar Gleeman. Thanks for listening to Nerdy Show. Nerdy Show is made possible by a comic shop, Nerdapalooza, and the generous support of listeners like you. As listener-supported entertainment, we rely on you to keep this and other shows on the Nerdy Show Network alive by telling a friend, rating and reviewing us on the iTunes, or making a contribution to our monthly support drive, or to your favorite Gleeman. Any size contribution gets you exclusive Nerdy Show audio and images and lets you participate in our monthly support drives. Just go to nerdyshow.com/support to chip in. For more episodes of Nerdy Show, Dungeons and Doritos, as well as other fine programming, community forums, videos, articles, and more, head on over to nerdyshow.com. You can subscribe to all Nerdy Show Network podcasts via the iTunes Store. And for the latest news, follow us on all your favorite social networks. Tune in via Crystal